everyone. I'm Evelyn.
And I'm Lara. We are the host of Once Upon a Niger podcast, where we take you down history lane as we break down stories about people, places, and events in Nigeria's past and present.
That's right. In every episode, we will take you on a journey of our own discoveries as we feed our curiosity and connect with our heritage. Join us to figure out how the chronicles of the past can help write tomorrow's tale. Okay, Lara, welcome. You look so shocked. You look shocked to be here. You're like, is it now that we're recording a pod?
Am I really here? Ah, welcome. Hi, Evelyn. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm tired.
Is it the weather? Do you think it's like too hot?
That might be contributing to it. Like, it is a bit stuffy. It's a bit stuffy in this UK.
How did you survive last week's heatwave?
By the grace of God, I survived that heatwave. I made sure that I did not move. So I stayed at home and I was in my room. I had a fan that was on me constantly. I didn't turn the fan off. I opened all the windows in the house. And I just moved very, very slowly.
Wow.
And I was okay, you know. I think it probably made me tired like throughout the week, but generally I felt okay.
I was the opposite. Because I had to, so it didn't really help because I organised a bake-off at work. I planned it, well, my team and I have been planning, we planned it like a month in advance and we picked the day after the heat wave. So the heat wave was on a Tuesday. The bake-off at work was on a Wednesday. So I'd gotten a few people to sign up, you know, to bake. I come and see people dropping out. They're like, I can't turn on my oven. I'm like, you're not actually baking yourself in the oven. Like, even the preparation of the, you know, whatever you're baking is outside of the oven. It's just for you to put it in the oven and walk away.
Yeah.
They're like, I don't think I can put my oven on today. It's too hot. And I think I had like 8 people drop out.
Really?
And I was just saying, oh Lord, I hope that this bake-off actually happens the next day. But thankfully it did. Yeah, so I was busy baking in the evening in that heat. And we had a fire near my area.
Oh,
yeah,
because you
know, no, because you know, like, it set off the heat, set off
lots of like wildfires and stuff.
Wildfires, yeah. And a few houses actually got burnt.
Yeah.
So like the next day on my way to work, all the area that I would normally pass through was like blocked, and there were like TV crew coming to report.
Yeah,
about the fire.
I saw some on the news, which is just crazy. Yeah. It's really, really crazy.
So when I eventually went back past the area, about 6 houses burnt. Like literally
6.
Nothing. So like there's a row of 3 houses, then there's like another row of 3 houses where they were okay, but then the next row of 3 houses was also burnt. So there's like 6 houses in total. And like, you know, when I heard like houses got burnt, because I didn't watch it on telly, because I could actually smell the smoke. I could see the smoke from like my area. That was how close it was.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was going on. Then someone told me that there was fire in the area. So the next time I was passing the area, I thought it would be like, you know, sometimes you see fire and there's like black marks on the wall and stuff like that. Everything.
No.
People literally lost everything. Like you can see the hollow of the house, like.
Yeah, that's really horrible. That's really sad.
Yeah. So for people who don't know what we're talking about, like London had a heat wave or UK had a heat wave last week, Tuesday, whenever you hear this now. But at some point in the month of July.
Any British person that you're listening to, they would have been talking about
this heat wave. A Nigerian that I know who recently moved to the UK, he just didn't understand it. It was just like, what is this heat wave you people are talking about? Like Abuja is like 2 times hotter than this, and nobody's complaining about us. Like, listen, you won't understand.
No.
But yeah, so can't complain though. We're glad it's still summer.
Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, like, what if I'm paying attention, the weather is a bit in the plus 20s, which is not normal for the UK, which is both like bad and good, because obviously things, nature are more difficult, but then
I'm just like, British people just don't know what they want. Like, they're happy to pay to go abroad, for this sort of weather. Mm. But when it's on your doorstep, you just keep hearing, oh, it's so hot. Oh, it's so... I just like, give me a
that's
break.
A, yeah, that's a British thing. I'm not being satisfied.
Yeah. But anyway,
yeah,
I'm not complaining. Long may this heat last.
Yeah.
Other than that, all good.
All good. It would have been better, I think, if the film that we were going to review today
was good.
Pause. Was good. So today we're going to be chatting about the film of the father of Nigerian nationalism, Herbert Macaulay. The film is called The Herbert Macaulay Affair, made in 2019. And it's a biopic about his life and about the accomplishments and the fights that he fought. And I can't lie, I'm sad to start off a film review in this way, but the film left a lot to be desired. I just have to be honest.
Dear. Ouch.
I'm going to get it off my chest.
Ouch. That was a very strong feeling.
I feel strongly about it. I mean, this man is an incredibly important person.
That's right.
In Nigeria's history. And he's a figure that you really do need to take your time with, and his story should be handled with delicacy, with care, with passion, and it should be placed...
with expertise.
That's the word. That's the word, hey, Lara.
Expertise.
And I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to that man that directed it. I'm so sorry to that team. But there is work to be done. There are things to be improved. Let's give a bit of a context.
Yeah,
of
back to basics.
Yeah, first things first. What is the film about? It's about Herbert Macaulay, and he was a large proponent of like fighting off the British. And the film anyway starts. And what year did it start? It starts on his return from the UK. So Herbert Macaulay had been educated in the UK, had shown some academic brilliance and had studied there for a time, and he comes back to Lagos and he's working for the colonial administration at the time, and there starts the story, and you can start to see the frustration, and he starts to recognize the discrimination that is occurring amongst people, or is happening against the Lagosian people versus the administrators. Mm-hmm. So that's where like the film starts.
Yeah. And I think they also introduced us at the beginning to his family, where they showed his mother. And I think that the first introduction to him was sort of like, you know, portraying this man as a sophisticated, elegant man, I believe. And I think they also tried to put some sort of like spiritual conflict where I think his family were Christians or
Anglican,
yeah. But he was more sort of interested in the traditional way of things.
Yeah, I think he was probably more, what's the word, liberal.
Yeah, yeah, he was.
With his beliefs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like you were saying, with the conflict he had with the British colonial administration, one thing that I noted was that it wasn't quite clear, it wasn't well established what were the things that triggered his
anti-colonial spirit.
I don't want to say hatred. Yeah, his anti-colonial spirit, because they just showed us like certain scenes where, and okay, I'm not going to digress. I'm going to finish my point. They showed us scenes where they had like the English actors, you know, just kind of going back and forth, and him being upset with them and him just standing up against whatever it was that they were doing, and them just sort of like floundering around, and you know, there was that scene with the monkey, and it was just, and the point I wanted to make is, if we're producing a film in Nigeria that requires the involvement of foreign actors, you need to have foreign actors that can actually act. Like, it's not good enough.
Wow, some filmmaking 101.
It's not good enough. Listen, basics. Yeah, I digress. Recently, I was approached by somebody who's looking to actually make a film in Nigeria.
Hey, scouted.
Listen, this pod is going places, just in case you don't know. Very confidential at the moment, but I can't talk about it at the moment.
I signed an NDA and all that stuff.
But, you know, the film is going to require the involvement of foreign white actors. And he was asking me, and, you know, we're talking about it. And the very first thing I said to him, when he showed me a few people, I said, can they act? Like, I know it sounds very obvious, but this is such a... And it feels like we're digressing a little bit, but I think it's so important because the way these things are portrayed, it's just like it can either make or break the story you're telling. And it just kind of gives it this amateurish, you know, we can't really find a good, we don't have the budget. So we're just going to put this any which way person there just so we can show that we've got a foreign person. So, and when I say foreign, I mean, you know, even people, when we've had like Asian people in our films, like that Namaste Wahala film, I don't know if you've watched it. You know, it's just all of the above. But anyway, moving on. Yes. So what else do you think about the
thoughts? Okay, to be not too depressing about this, let's talk about what we understood them attempting to do. So they're attempting to depict key moments in Herbert Macaulay's life. And I think it's good that they were trying to portray these important scenarios. And I think there was actually a good attempt to go on location and sort of show at least colonial style buildings. So I was glad at that attempt, and I think, I don't know, like the quality of the camera wasn't the worst.
I feel like the lighting, because it felt really bleak. Like it felt really
That's a good point. The cinematography
just felt really like dark, and you know, there wasn't color, and I can appreciate that perhaps that was one of the techniques they were applying to show that this was set back in the days where, you know, probably videography wasn't really, there was no colour and all that stuff. And I think that was because I was reading somewhere and, you know, the review made a good point about the fact that because Nigeria hasn't done a great job of keeping the historical buildings. So I can imagine that the team that made this film had a really tough time trying to find a good location that was going to be appropriate for the film. And therefore, they had to employ other means to re-establish their point. So one of the ways I think they did that was the lighting, which when you're watching it, you're not really thinking about the logic behind it. You're just thinking, why is it so bleak? Why is it so like, even as a black and white film, you just feel like, you know, something wasn't quite right. But I think also,
and it's not a black and white film, by the way.
No, but it felt like it was black and white to me. Like,
no, there were a lot of scenes. The majority of the film, it was very cool tones. Yeah, and as you said, that might have been a stylistic choice to try and portray the bleakness of the situation, of the fact that, you know, being colonized wasn't a good thing.
Yeah,
I think there were actually good attempts, even when they couldn't show the facade of a building properly, like the interior.
Yeah.
There was an attempt I could see to try and make the interior design of the buildings look appropriate to the time. But still, even then, the costuming, I'm not an academic, I'm not a fashion scholar when it comes to the correct costuming of different periods. Yeah. But I have feeling it didn't feel very Victorian, the clothing. I mean, he came back to Lagos in 1893. So I feel as though you would still have, I believe Queen Victoria was still on the throne.
He was a man, he was a Nigerian man. So fair enough, he went to the UK and, you know, we're trying to show the fact that he's got this connection and this British education. But he was a Nigerian man. And throughout the film, it felt like they were always in costume.
He was a Lagosian. What do you?
Well, it was a Lagosian. Very true. Nigeria was not yet
Nigeria.
Nigeria was not yet a thing. So he was a Lagosian. He was a Yoruba man.
Yeah.
Right. Why were they always in costumes? Like, are you telling me there was never a time when, even when they showed him in his house, he was wearing suits and he was wearing a three-piece suit a lot of the time. I'm sure he was wearing Ankara and
he must
Adire and other things,
especially as Herbert Macaulay is constantly, when you read about him anyway, he's constantly referred to as a man that was a champion of like native interest and was and connected a lot with the local communities in that area. So you're right, it seems strange that he wouldn't have worn the clothing. And within the film, he's regularly speaking Yoruba.
Yeah, exactly, so yeah. Which was quite impressive, by the way.
Yeah, that was good. I think that was actually, you're right. That was a good and redeeming quality of the film.
Yeah.
That a lot of the dialogue was in. The subtitles were still too small there. So I was squinting, and I mean, that's not very like inclusive for people who, you know.
Yeah. And speaking of like, you know, acknowledging the difficulties they would have had with location and perhaps depending on what their budget was, because I know some people actually create their own sets and, you know, they try to make certain things work. But I felt like there were certain scenes that could have just been, they could have been a lot more creative with how they, with the locations that they used. So, you know, part of the stories they told was the relationship he had with like the market, the leader of the market women, who I believe was Madam Alimotu Gbelewura, I think that's her name. But they showed scenes where, like, this is a market leader. She lives and breathes marketplaces, right?
Yeah.
Why is she meeting with you on a field in the middle of nowhere to talk about the grievances that she has with the British administration? I just felt like you could have met in the marketplace, you know, if you're really having difficulties. You know, a marketplace would have been perfect. Like, do whatever colour grading you need to do to make it look like it was back in... I mean, it would not be difficult. Like, I'm sure there are many marketplaces that look like they were still in the 1800s, to be honest, in Nigeria.
That's even
easily find them. So, you know, so I feel like there are certain areas where I just felt like they could have put a bit more effort and thought into actually, into the setting. But another point that I would make in favor of them is I appreciate the attempt to actually, because if you recall one of the films we reviewed, we talked about the fact that it was actually lacking in historical content, where it's a historical film, but there's very little, like, we finished watching the film and we didn't feel like we knew any better about what actually happened in that historical time. But I think with this film, they touched on, the content was great. I think the content was good in the sense that they were touching on things that actually happened. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it perfectly, but they actually touched on it. So when you finish watching the film, you know, you might need to watch it twice, actually. You know, I guess because of the knowledge I already had about the person and the event, I was able to, when certain things were happening, I was able to kind of put the puzzle together.
Right.
But, you know, once you've watched it once and twice and then perhaps done your own research, then you're able to appreciate the elements that they were trying to introduce in the film. So, like, for example, you know, his wife and the lady who he married and died at childbirth, you know, that happened. That was his, you know, that was his wife. The Madam Halimotu Gbelewura thing, you know, that was a reality. The stuff that was happening with the colonial administration, that was, but the background story was just missing. It was just that they were very surface level, but at least they portrayed, they didn't make it, you know, sometimes like with the, what was this film that we, with the Lady Warrior?
Queen Amina,
that's it. We felt that it was lacking. They had to make up quite a lot of things for it. So it kind of felt like this mystical figure as opposed to an actual person. But I guess because Herbert Macaulay was more recent time, with more recent history, they would have had more content to actually play with.
I feel as though, to summarise the Herbert Macaulay affair, is that it is a film. It is filmed like a Wikipedia entry. You know, it's, if you go on Wikipedia and read Herbert Macaulay's biography, it feels as though it's very concise,
choppy,
and for a Wikipedia entry, that's perfect, because I'm getting just enough information to give me an idea of the type of man and the sort of achievements he's made. But in a film, I should be able to connect with the man. I should feel an emotional attachment to him, his family, his cause, And I didn't feel that. It felt as though it was just literally repeating what had been written in this online encyclopedia.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to watch that. Like, that's not compelling.
I totally hear that. And yeah, I think there's a part of me, knowing how the Nollywood film industry in the area of historical film genre is still very much in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would always give them some credit for effort. And I think that's about it. It's just like, I would always give them credit for effort of telling the stories. And I think all these films we've reviewed in the last couple of months, hopefully they're going to be the foundation for better and more expertly produced movies in the future where we can actually enjoy what has been created. But I think the film producers are all just kind of testing the waters, and I think they've all recognized that there's something missing in the Nollywood film genre. They've all recognized, or they're starting to recognize, that we need more historical films, we need more you know, biopics, we need more of this sort of things. And they're all just starting to, so when they see the content, they don't really know, they're not yet clued up as to how to bring it to life and how to make it more like relatable and presentable and get people connected to these, you know, figures, which, you know, is a fair point that you made. But we're hoping that bigger and better things will come.
I think that the point you make is a symptom of the and I'm sure there are people who, well, obviously there are people in the industry who understand the difficulties that are faced. To me, it's obviously clear that there isn't access to like a quality like writer's room or teaching or expertise in writing historical film or historical fiction. So like you said, that's an area that needs serious like development.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, obviously like literature is a different art form, you know, that like the novel is different from writing a screenplay. But in my mind, I do think surely these two different types of writer, right, the playwright and the author, surely those worlds can come together where there can be support or a sharing of knowledge and method. To
Evelyn, what playwright? How many playwriters do we have in Nigeria?
Hey.
How many playwrights?
I mean, the same playwright. I mean, screenwriter.
Oh, screenwriter.
I mean, screenwriter, sorry. Yeah, like, they're writers.
True.
They're writers. Like, and I know there are writers' rooms, there are. I know that there are courses or camps, you know, where writers do come together and they share their work and they improve their work. It's just, to me, and the listeners who are, you know, in this world, please educate and share more about what that process looks like. What are the pitfalls? I know there's a conversation happening amongst yourselves about what needs to happen in the industry. Help the audience understand because this is, but we want better. These are really important stories. We want to watch and learn about Herbert Macaulay. Like, we were speaking earlier in preparation for this episode about the fact that some people, and many people, thought that Herbert Macaulay was a white man.
Yeah.
You know, and I can understand that, you know, if you just hear the name, you're not thinking Lagosian.
Yoruba
man.
I mean, he does have a Yoruba name there as well, but it's commonly referred to as Herbert Macaulay, but it's Herbert Olayinka Macaulay.
Yeah, and the fact that he has been immortalized in the Nigerian state with statues and roads named after him.
The more popular one on the 1 naira currency.
Yeah.
Which is how I grew up knowing him, actually. I don't recall. I'm sure, you know, I learnt about him in primary school in Nigeria, in social studies or social sciences or whatever, but then history was later taken out of the curriculum. So I'm sure it was in those early days. And all I knew was that, you know, he's the man on the, because you learn about all these people on the currency, right? He's like, oh, this person is on the whatever note, that person. And so he was just the man on the 1 naira note for the longest time to me. Like, I did not have a clue who he was, what he did, why he was significant, why he was even on the 1 naira note. And again, obviously the picture picture of him there is quite, it's not like a coloured picture where you can tell that, oh, this is a black man, you know, and especially with his moustache, with his figure and everything, it was an enigma. It could have been anybody, to be honest. So, yeah. But speaking of, just quickly before we actually talk about, you know, Herbert Macaulay, the man, from our own perspective and what we know about him. Speaking of what you've just said about, you know, the effort that needs to go into the making of these historical dramas, I'm really looking forward. I sent you a link the other day to this new film that is going to come out in, I think it's in September.
October. The Viola Davis film, Viola Davis, Woman King,
and John Boyega. I think it's called The Woman King, which is meant to depict the lives of the Dahomey warriors.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping, because I'm sure that film has a big budget behind it, and you know the production, everything. I'm hoping that they really do a good job, and that as we are setting pace, that it would then be the the standards are going to just keep going up and up.
Yeah.
And also, even that same film house today released the fact that they're also producing one of Wole Soyinka's plays, which is The King's Horseman.
Okay.
So again, that's something I think is going to come out later in the year on Netflix. That's something that I'm also looking forward to.
That's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it can only get better, hopefully.
You know what? That's a good way to, that's a good way to
wrap this up.
We started off on a bit of a downer, but yes, let's end with optimism on the review. Yeah.
So speaking of Herbert Macaulay, the man, and who he actually was, so, you know, putting the film aside for now. So Herbert Macaulay, I mean, he came from his mother was Samuel Ajayi Crowther's daughter. So
yes,
so Samuel Ajayi Crowther is also probably another, you know, figure we should speak about at some point in time. But he was a very significant man as well in, not Nigeria, obviously, because it was way before Nigeria happened, but in the Yoruba kingdom, because that was how he was at the time. And so he was Ajayi Crowther's grandson. And so his family were quite influential. Like he was, you know, he came from a, probably what you would call a middle class family.
Yeah, family of prominence, of prominence, or pedigree.
Yeah, at that time. He was born in Lagos. His father was, I believe, a vice chancellor of some institution in Lagos. I don't remember now. But anyway, so he was born at a time, now setting the background to the time when Macaulay was born. So in Lagos State, at the time, this was 3 years after Lagos had committed itself to the British protection. So it became a British colony in 1881, I believe it was. And again, this
1861.
Was 1861. It was 1861, right. And this was because the Eleko of Lagos had agreed to some things with the British government. I can't quite remember what it was now. So 3 years later, he was born into this new era where the British had agreed to take over Lagos, and they had also promised to protect Lagos. They promised to protect, you know, everything that had to do with the people and all that stuff, the administration. But when Macaulay was born and he was growing up, he was educated, he was identified as an excellent student. Then he got scholarship to go to Plymouth.
He got
a scholarship to go to Plymouth, and he studied civil engineering. After his education, he returned back to Nigeria, to Lagos. He returned back to Lagos colony, and he was subsequently appointed as a surveyor. Now, I was trying to, actually, one thing I said I was going to do was actually find out what surveyors do. I know it's to do with land and things like that, but I would have loved to kind of understand more of the technical aspects of the job. And I guess it was shortly after this that in this role was when he started to really identify the issues that he later took up, and the things that I would say later sort of became the source of his legacy and what he was well known for and praised for. So we're going to speak about some of those things. What are the things that brought him to prominence, really? But do you want to say anything about just some of those early days, what you found about him or what you thought was a bit notable?
Yeah, so as mentioned in the film, Herbert Macaulay came back to Lagos and he was a surveyor, and he started working in the colonial administration. But upon his return from the UK, he recognized and started to see that there was a lot of like racial discrimination, and I think that's in the civil service, and I think that's what ignited and sparked a lot of his resentment for the indirect rule and the racist behavior of the white officials that were he was working with at the time. There was an intolerance, there was a disrespect and a disregard for the few that were working, the few like Yoruba people or local people that were working in the government or in the administration. And I think that frustration and the lack of representation in the civil service and in the legislature at large, it then provoked him to start campaigning against that and also eventually leave his work.
Yeah.
And I think that shows, I think, you know, at that time,
that was a brave move.
It was brave, you know.
It was very brave because, you know, he not only resigned, he resigned to establish his own architecture and engineering company in Lagos. And I mean, yes, you're probably going to have a few people who are going to patronize you, but there was very limited scope for what he was doing. I don't know what to call it, like scope for what he was doing in terms of people who have done it before him, or like, you know, people starting to establish their own companies, knowing how much of a hold the British administration had on a lot of the things that were happening in that area at the time. So it was a very, very bold statement for him to make. And I think resigning was probably like his first major activism, I would say, you know, because then after he resigned, then he started writing a weekly column in the Lagos Daily Times. And I guess now that he's no longer part of the government, he had the liberty and, you know, the opportunity he needed to like criticize the government's policies on issues like racial segregation. You know, I think at the time they were even planning to build a separate church for white government officials. Yeah. You know, the water rate scheme, free press law, there was efforts to prohibit indigenous ownership of land. Yeah. And we know that land ownership is like a big thing, even in the UK. So
it's a big thing anywhere and everywhere.
Anywhere in the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, the one thing I want to say is like, he's such an impressive man that he was an engineer, he was a journalist, he was a politician, he was like,
He had a coat of many colours.
He was just like,
only you want all the talents.
You know, it just shows like, yeah, he was a really brilliant man. And again, just an example of the crop, the quality of the people of that land
at that time as well.
Yeah. Very, it's like, it's always just refreshing and encouraging to like read that, you know, people like him existed.
Yeah. And actually, one of the very first pamphlets he wrote when he started writing and speaking out against the government policies was a pamphlet titled Governor Egerton and the Railway. And it was basically exposing the corrupt activity amongst white officials of the railway. And when I thought of this, last week I went to a place in England. I went to Suffolk for the benefit of our listeners who are not in the UK. It's a place in England. It's a small village. And as my tourist historical self, I went into like one of the museums to look at, you know, the history of the town. And you know, the one thing the UK does well, and I think Europe does well, is no matter how small the town is, how irrelevant the town is, how obscure...
Look at you complimenting and then insulting
At the same time, how obscure, because, you know, the town is like, because it was a historical, at least it had some historical relevance and significance. See, the place they put this historical thing, it was like one small room. It was actually part of like the council office, whatever. But like on the down part of the building, they just had like this historical place where they've got like stories on the wall, artifacts, all these different things. And one of the stories I read was about the corruption that was happening in the UK at the time during the political election, where the MPs were paying people to vote for them. So like literally what would happen in Nigeria now where you pay people like 10,000 to like vote for you, and at the time there was no way you could collect the money and then say, oh, I'm gonna do something else, because they had a way of like actually monitoring you. And I thought, how interesting is that? Because that is exactly what happens in Nigeria. And I'm thinking, perhaps Nigeria got it from these people, because I never thought there was a time when, you know, with how advanced and sophisticated our political system in the UK is now, to think there was a time when, you know, MPs were actually paying people on the streets to vote for them, to the point where, you know, one of them was like arrested. And I thought, I'm sure Nigeria didn't just start doing this because, you know, but I highlight that to speak about the corruption that Herbert Macaulay was writing about. And I think, you know, seeing that, not to say that I was oblivious or naive of how corrupt the UK government can be or was at the time, but I think it just sort of like brought it home for me. Like, actually, yeah, these things were happening. And you had this African man writing and speaking against it, and, you know, sending letters back to the UK to say this is what's happening, publishing. And you can imagine the hatred they had for him, because it was just like, you're obstructing our...
he was definitely an irritant, you know, especially as he was writing, he was getting more popularity amongst local people. And that was proving frustrating to them, especially when he then set his eyes on a land case, the Oloapapa land case. And that was a famous like land dispute where the Olua family during colonial times, the colonial administration had bought, I think, a sizable amount of land from them. But they had, I don't know what the term you would use, they had screwed them over, basically. They had screwed them over. And so instead of paying them what the land was worth, they paid them £500 at that time.
Imagine.
Now, the family realised that this is
a pittance.
This is not, I know my worth.
This is chicken change.
I know my worth. I know my land is worth. Like, you're not going to come and swindle me.
That's it.
So, you know, the Oluwa family sought, you know, they worked with Herbert Macaulay, and Herbert Macaulay supported them in appealing to not only the colonial administration, but then even the Queen's Privy Council.
The Privy Council, yeah.
At the time. So travelling all the way to London to reject, you know, what the payment that had been made.
Because what had happened was, in Lagos, they had actually done the initial appeal, because obviously before you can go to the Privy Council, you need to have done a local appeal first. And the appeal was thrown out, it was rejected. The £500 was established as the right fee. And that was when Herbert Macaulay joined forces with the Apapa family and went to the Privy Council in London, like you said. And yeah, what happened?
Yeah, and they went to the Privy Council, and, you know, I guess surprisingly to me, I was surprised that they actually said, you know what, you're absolutely right, this land is worth more than that 500. And the number that they came back with.
Hey!
The number that they came back with.
Hey!
I said, wow.
Ah.
I said, this is a massive disrespect.
Absolute disrespect. So the number... No respect whatsoever. How dare you?
The number they came back with was £22,500.
That's a hefty man.
That's like big, big money.
That's an absolute mockery, right? And just, it just illustrates the unfairness in the initial pittance that they'd offered them. And you know what? This Privy Council in London really surprised me on a few occasions, because this is not the first time that they're going to rule in favour. Right?
No.
But they ruled in favour, which, what is that? Because it just felt like the British administration were rogues. They just decided to do their own stuff, right? Because if after going to the Privy Council, they're going to establish, you know, for the claimant, as it were, it just makes you think, is it not this? Don't you have a rule book? Don't you have guides and, you know, rules and regulations?
No, well, they do, but they have rules for themselves, and they have rules for others. And then the overriding rule is like, does this work in our ultimate favor?
Mm.
So for them, you know what? They're probably thinking, we can allow this one to go because you've got to give them something so that they don't completely revolt, right?
So you think the Privy Council was also being diplomatic?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They're not just being...
They don't want it to stir too much. They can see the popularity of this man. They can see that he's getting a good reception. They can... He's campaigning on the behalf of the people. He's not only speaking English, he's speaking a Yoruba that they do not understand. So they're even nervous. They're like, no. We've got to give them something.
Yeah. I can see that. But that judgment of the Oluwa case really set a precedent for the compensation of all the other chiefs, because Oluwa family, obviously the man was a chief, and this issue of land ownership was all across, you know, many other families, mm-hmm. and, you know, fighting for their land and for their rightful compensation. So it really did set the precedent for all the other chiefs to be rightly compensated for the land. So that was like the very first case that was one of the major cases that set Herbert Macaulay on the world stage, as it were. And then the second case was the case of the Eleko of Lagos. Now, with this one, Herbert Macaulay was still in London with the Oluwa case family,
yeah.
when he just said, let me kill two birds with one stone. Why not? So whilst we're talking about this Oluwa case, lad, there's another case, my lord, that I must call your attention to. And this is a case of, he basically took the opportunity to canvass for the rights of traditional rulers. Mm-hmm. So basically, obviously, with the colonial administration coming with their own ideologies about ruling and governance, they were almost relegating these traditional rulers to the side and really just disrespecting them and not, you know, usurping the authority and the power. And so the Eleko of Lagos was like the king of Lagos, basically. And actually, it was the grandfather of the Eleko of Lagos who surrendered Lagos to the British, and the ruler, you know, he surrendered the Lagos to the British, and the British obviously in return decided, gave them certain promises, because you don't just surrender your territory without some compensation or some promises of something in return, right? But it very quickly backfired and it wasn't as they expected. So they confronted the authorities about their failure to honour the promise that they'd made to pay compensation to the grandfather of the Eleko and those kind of things. And also they believed that the colonial government was acting in a countercultural manner and they were undermining the authority of the Eleko as a king. And how did this actually happen? So the Eleko opposed I think they were trying to introduce pipe-borne water in Lagos, and the Eleko said, well, he objected. And why did he object? A, they had not previously informed him. So I'm guessing now you look back and you think, pipe-borne water, and so why is it a significant thing? But back then it was a very significant thing because it was infrastructure. Somebody had to pay for it. It would have meant more taxation. And as the traditional ruler and the owner of the land, technically speaking, you should have consulted me about this sort of major development in my land. And so the Eleko objected, and he was convinced that this pipe-borne water that they were looking to install was really primarily for the benefit of the white people, of the Europeans. They were the ones you wanted, despite the advantage that it might have given to the locals as well. But primarily it was for their benefit. And he said, if you want it, you pay for it. Right? Mm-hmm. So they were not going to settle for taxation without representation, especially if they were not going to consult them about the development. And so these were all the things, that some of the things that were happening. And so consequently, because Eleko opposed these pipe-borne water, they then withdrew his recognition as king. And then, and then they suspended his stipend. So this is really...
Listen, you can see my face right now. Yeah. It's just the audacity. What do you mean you're going to remove his authority?
Yeah.
Like, how can you remove authority that it was never yours?
It was never your place to give. Yeah. Yeah. So, but they didn't... So them saying they were going to remove his recognition and actually suspending his stipend in the hope that he was going to come back, you know, with his tails between his legs, asking them for money and all that stuff, that backfired. That didn't happen, because guess what? The people, the local people supported him. The market women, you know, provided him with food. Other people financially supported him. So it was materially sustained, at least for the meantime until the case was heard in London. And guess what the Privy Council did again this time? Second surprise, they ruled in his favour. Yeah. They ruled in the favour of the Eleko family. And again, this was another momentous verdict and one thing that established Herbert Macaulay as a champion and defender of the native rights and liberties. So, yeah, they ruled in favour of the Eleko. And what they had actually said, the Privy Council confirmed that the administrators in Lagos, they'd acted unlawfully in the appointment of a new king. Because not only did they depose him, they actually installed a new king. Their own king. Like, it was just ridiculous. And they said, it is the assent of a community that gives validity to a customary law. So it is the people who say, kings are not just put in place by, it's not arbitrary. The people agree. There's a system, there's a kind of like family, you know, system and everything like that. So yeah. But you know what the funny thing is? These administrators in Nigeria, they were stubborn. Because they didn't give effect to the verdict in the UK. It took another 11 years before the Eleko was actually allowed to...
Oh, this is true.
Yeah, it took another 11 years. Yeah, so even though the deposition of him was pronounced as illegal, but instead of giving immediate effect to the ruling of the Privy Council, he spent another 11 years in exile before he was finally allowed to return to Lagos. In 1931.
And then he was given a stipend, or there were things that were bestowed on him again, but unfortunately he didn't live
long to enjoy whatever.
Yeah, live long to enjoy that, which is a shame.
Yeah. So this was some of the winnings of Herbert Macaulay. These were some of the things that set him on stage. But then Herbert Macaulay, obviously this then triggered other aspects of his life. Like we said, he was a man of many talents. So the activist now, Herbert Macaulay the politician, right? Because his influence and reputation that he had, he just kind of like kept growing, and he started to build this kind of anti-colonial nationalist movement where he then founded the very first Nigeria political party. So they'd always had like associations and things like that, but as a very kind of like first full party, political party, he founded the Nigerian National Democratic Party.
And by this time in history, Nigeria is Nigeria.
So. Yes, yes.
So when the party was founded in 1923, so the northern and southern Nigerian protectorate became one. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight.
No, very true, because that happened in 1914. Mm-hmm. So yeah, about less than 10 years later, this first political party was instituted. And they very quickly started winning, I don't know if it was election, but seats in the legislature, and they were starting to gain prominence, and people supported them, especially in Lagos and Calabar. And the party's motto was, the safety of the people is the greatest law. And what were some of the things they were advocating for? So the party was advocating for an independent Lagos government. It was advocating for compulsory primary education. They were for more significant representation of Nigerians in the colonial government, and for non-discriminatory practices in civil service occupation. So some of the things that, from the very start of his career that he was still advocating for kind of like fed into his political party, his party's agenda. And they experienced a lot of success. And yeah.
I mean, they did experience a lot of success. I suppose, though, reading that, I find it interesting that whenever I hear about anti-colonial affairs or a push for independence, my expectation is that it will always be quite radical. Yeah. But when I read this and listen to this, it's not as radical as I would have hoped.
Yeah.
It was, and even his contemporaries, or those that came after him, you look at Herbert Macaulay's sort of like politics, and he's not as anti-Brit. I mean, we've spoken a lot about how he, rejected the racism and discrimination, etc. But in terms of like general like anti-Britishness, I mean,
it was quite conservative.
He was actually like quite conservative. He didn't necessarily want to like kick them out, so to speak. He wanted what I would look at now as like he wanted reform, you know. He was not revolutionary. And I suppose, and I agree, especially with, like, you know, his successors and the younger, more radical politicians that he then later collaborated with, there was a fair criticism. It was like, you cannot like still be listen, working.
You need to kick them at the door. Yeah, that was what they were saying. And you're right. And you know very fair point, because then shortly after he established his own party and this new set of radical young people, like, you know, Nnamdi Azikiwe, Chief Obafemi Awolowo, all the likes of them, they came and they formed their own national youth movement. National Youth Movement, which was more radical, saying that, yeah, they had like what they were actually looking for. And he had no choice but to eventually, well, not that he had no choice. The thing is,
that was the movement. That was the swell.
Yeah. But the thing is, what that group was lacking, they lacked the experience that Herbert Macaulay had. So eventually they had to collaborate to kind of push the agenda to the maximum, basically. And so even the National Youth Movement in itself, they couldn't, there was a rift between them. So it didn't remain NYM for too long. Eventually, Nnamdi Azikiwe went his own way.
Oh, yeah.
Obafemi Awolowo went his own way. They formed two separate parties. So Nnamdi Azikiwe formed the NNCN or NN something. Nigerian National and Cameroon something, yeah, right? And then Obafemi Awolowo formed the Action Group.
Yeah.
But I suppose in that...
Let's go. National Council of Nigeria and the Cameroons.
That's it. I apologize, my people. Sorry. So there you go.
National Council of Nigeria and the Cameroons.
So NC, NC.
That's right.
Come on. Okay. Yeah. And so they formed that party. And I suppose Herbert Macaulay had a... He aligned more with the NCNC because he thought that they were more Pan-Africa... They had a more Pan-Africa agenda.
Yeah.
So they collaborated together, and together they were able to make a lot of progress.
So they did get a lot of popularity. There was a lot more success, you know, because he brought that almost that like elder statesman.
That's right.
Prestige and experience to the group. And I think what I think is interesting about this union or this coming together of these two characters and this new vision, this new nationalist vision of Nigeria. I think it's wonderful that there was this uniting against British rule. I suppose one of the questions I have for myself while I was thinking is that, you know, and when I think compared to today and how we're constantly talking about Nigerians need to unite, you know, against corruption, we need to unite against an enemy. I wonder what things would look like if we're uniting around something that isn't about, I don't know how to describe this, isn't about like an enemy. It's not about pushing someone out, but it's about,
yeah,
it's about
looking at the enemy within as opposed to the enemy without. Look internally. Come on, people.
Yeah, no, there's, yeah, definitely that. And I suppose, you know, thinking as to how can we come together to better ourselves, and the betterment of our own situation is not solely focused on rejecting the British, right?
Yeah.
But it's about saying it makes sense for us to pool our resources together so that we can all improve our lives, right? And I think there is a difference.
Yeah.
And there's a different quality to the energy when you focus on uniting. I think there's a different quality from uniting against, yeah, the without, the external,
yeah,
and uniting because you see the value, you see the dignity, you see the benefits of actually reaching across tribal differences, tribal lines, and being like, yes, we have our differences, but like that's our goal, is to improve each other's lots. Like, if we help one another, we help ourselves.
I think they had a better time doing that in the early days of Nigeria. But as time went on, the tribal differences became more solidified and it became sort of the basis on which a lot of things were then instituted. So, I mean, now in Nigerian politics, they talk about, oh, we need to have a, you know, this last term we had a Yoruba president. Now we need to have a Hausa president. Now we need to, and it's just like, if we all want Nigeria, we just need to have the best candidate for the job. And again, I'm sure this happens in many other countries as well, where you've got like all the small political parties and you have like two major parties and perhaps you have a third challenger party. But it's like this third challenger party is not strong enough. You need all the other smaller ones to combine together to be behind this third challenger to, you know, actually have a chance of winning or having influence. So no, I totally hear your point in that we're too, but I don't see, I don't want to say I don't see that happening in Nigeria anytime soon. There's just too many, we've created too many differences for ourselves that it's gonna be difficult to be able to come back to the center where we're able to look within. Because it would literally require everybody acquiescing about a particular agenda and saying this is what we're supporting. And when you've got 250 million people, however million people with however many languages, with however many ideologies, however many, you know, name it, it's just, it's almost impossible, you know? So, but we can only try. I mean, at the moment, everyone, well, most people are united with Obi, Peter Obi.
Yeah.
So that might be, that's a start.
You know, we'll get onto that in,
yeah.
In due course.
In due course. But anyway, so moving on with Macaulay. So at the time of the merger with Nnamdi Azikiwe's party, NNDP and NNCC merged and they decided to go with the name NNCC.
NCNC.
Oh my days. NCNC.
Yeah.
Yeah. By that time, you know, Herbert Macaulay was an elderly man in his 80s. Yes, they were able to unite over 40 groups by this act of merging and they had more resources to fight the struggle for Nigerian independence. But yeah, by that time, you know, he was fragile. His health was frail. And he eventually passed away the following year at the age of 81 in 1946. And that was the death of a nationalist.
Death of an icon.
Of an icon, yeah. And it was actually, and his icon status, I believe, was much celebrated because the amount of crowd that was reported to have, you know, attended his funeral and paid their last respect was about 200,000 people, which was quite significant. And he was buried at the Ikoyi Cemetery, which is another notable cemetery for, like, you know, burying
great leaders or significant leaders.
And then it was succeeded by Nnamdi Azikiwe, who then took on the baton and kept on the fight. And as we know, Nnamdi Azikiwe went on to become the first president of Nigeria. So, and Nnamdi Azikiwe had a lot of good things to say about Herbert Macaulay. He talked about the fact that in his speech, he talked about the fact that Herbert left an imperishable legacy, a struggle for social equality, economic security, religious tolerance and political freedom. He let them perpetuated ideas of freedom and you know, just really kind of gave the idea that we all have an obligation to prevent repeating this mistake of living in servitude. And I imagine he meant in servitude to the colonial administration. So yeah, and I think this is a fight for Nigeria now, where we're no longer in servitude to the colonial administration. We're now in servitude to ourselves, we're in servitude to our leaders who are supposed to be for us and serving us, but they're not. So it's kind of come back full circle.
I think there are two circles that are merging there for Nigeria. I still think, you know, on my research, it there still is this indirect rule from Western powers. It's just taken on a different form. So yeah. As I was reading, I was like, not much has changed. I was like, yeah, we've got... And I was just sad because I was just like, yeah, this is... It's that twofold thing. So you've got at the international level, you know, our leaders are in servitude towards external desires and agenda. And because of that, they refuse to serve the people as they should, as they have promised to. So then the Nigerian population is at the mercy, right, of the so-called Nigerian elite, is at the mercy of their willful incompetence and contempt, quite frankly, for them. So, I mean, yeah, I was... History really, it just be repeating itself.
It be repeating itself, and that's why it's so important to know it. Yeah. Because, you know, we always say, if you don't know your history, it's going to repeat itself. And I think a large part of the reason why Nigeria's history is repeating itself is because the Nigerians don't know it. You know, the government did a very fantastic job of erasing a large part of history and not really paying any significance to it. And that's why things are going to keep repeating themselves. But, you know, Herbert Macaulay was really, he earned this place in Nigeria's list of prominent people and heroes, frankly speaking. And he employed everything he had as far as, you know, as we know, his sophistication, his appreciation of history, his dexterity as a journalist at every point in pursuing what he wanted to. And he wasn't a perfect man. Many people had criticisms of him. There were many, and like, you know, one you highlighted that he had quite moderate views in terms of, you know, what the British were doing. And it was almost like a reform as opposed to an absolute get away from them. But all in all, he had the interests of the people at heart, I would say. Yeah.
So don't be discouraged by the negative film review. I'm sorry we started off so so negatively, but Herbert Macaulay, father of Nigerian nationalism, hero of our country, we're glad we spoke about him.
Yeah,
you'll remember his name.
He's not a white man.
That's it. He's not a white man. He's not a white man. Wasn't he was nicknamed the Oyubo something.
He was nicknamed Oyubo Alawodudu. Alawodudu, which means a white man in a black man's
in black skin in or
black
something.
Black skin. Yeah. I guess because of his sophistication or his appearance and whatnot.
Because he was doing, in like, as somebody in the film said, when he started doing grammar, I said I was like, hey, what do you mean? Why? What do you mean he's doing grammar? He's just speaking English. But anyway, that's another one.
There's English and there's English. English is different.
But anyway, we're rounding up. We're glad we got to speak about him. Hope you've learned a little thing or two about Macaulay. Do continue. We'll leave some show
notes. And guys, if you've enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend. Don't keep it to yourself. You know, spread the gospel. Help us out. Or share the good news. It's not quite the gospel.
But... You're getting excited there. Zealous.
Support the ministry. I haven't said that in a while. Support the ministry. I was watching a YouTube video today, and the guy said, "Would it be so bad to subscribe to my channel?" I said, "Exactly. Would it be so bad, eh? If you shared with a friend?"
Yes. And on that note, subscribe, follow, like, share, all of that good stuff. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Ciao.
Ciao.
So guys, thank you for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and learnt a thing or two.
Yep, you can find our episodes on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to keep up with us in between episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at Once Upon a Niger.
You can also find links to some further reading and information about the episode's topic in the show notes. If you want to encourage, collaborate, or as I like to say, support the ministry, drop us an email at onceuponaniger@gmail.com. Bye for now.
Bye.